Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's the My First Gig Podcast. Whoa. Sharing stories of first gigs and shows. Comedians sharing their memories. The fun and entertaining, exciting and crazy. With Dwayne Dugan as your host. It's the My First Gig Podcast. Here we go.
Looks like we made it. Look how far we've come, my baby.
Hey, guys. We are here. We have reached it. At last, a conclusion. 3 years in the making. It is the final episode of My First Gig with me, Dwayne Dugan. Series 3, episode 12. And what a fantastic guest I have today. I've had this episode in the bank for quite some time, and I wanted to save it for a series finale. Obviously, the first series was sidetracked by the pandemic. The second series was pandemic stories online, and now at last, the end of season 3. We may have taken a while to get here, but the wonderful, the iconic, the legend that is Phil Jupitus is closing out this season. Episode 30, and what a story it is. You'll hear once we get into the little chat there that when I ask, hey Phil, what's your first gig? He says, which one of them? Because he doesn't have one, he doesn't have two, he has 3 first gigs, and it is a great story. It's an extra long bonus chat. Phil was over doing a couple of shows in Dublin in March 2020. Literally the week. I know I say these were just before the week. Some were a couple of weeks, some were a couple of months. This was March 2020 before the lockdown happened. And Phil was over doing some shows around North Dublin. And we met in the beautiful seaside town of Howth in a hotel after he had completed the shows, ready to fly back to the UK. And he was very gracious with his time. I asked him for 30 minutes. He gave me an hour and a half. And you can get an hour of it right here on Acast for My First Gig. If you would like to hear more, if you would like an extended episode, if you would like some questions that you don't get here on the Acast feed, then go to patreon.com/myfirstgigpod and get early, get ad-free, and as I'm saying, get extended for just €5 a month on the Club Comic tier. And that's not all. While this is the season finale and I'm going to take a little break and come back with more episodes early next year, fear not if you are a Club Comic member on Patreon. Starting next week, I think next Friday, exclusively on Patreon, these will not be public. You will not see them in your iTunes app. You will not see them on Spotify. The only way to get these bonus episodes, we're going to have 10 bonus episodes with the stars of the Irish comedy scene, My First Gig, telling their first stories, kicking off next Friday, is by subscribing to Patreon. So head over to patreon.com/myfirstgig. And yeah, I'm delighted that we finally made it. It's mad that this was meant to end the season that started in 2020, but it just took a while. Obviously, the pandemic shut things down, but here we are. We finally made it, and I am delighted. It's been a trying couple of weeks, trying to secure interviews over the last couple of months while touring comics aren't necessarily happening, and I've snookered myself by making it exclusively touring comics because I have the second series on Patreon of the Irish comedy scene, so any comedians who live here are part of that. But I hope you've been enjoying the episodes last week. Give it up for the fantastic episode with Kai Humphries. Took me a second to remember, but yes, Kai Humphries, fantastic comedian, doing great stuff. He's got a couple of big shows over in the Stand in the UK, in Glasgow and in Newcastle, his hometown in Newcastle, almost sold out. So if you listened to that episode and you enjoyed Kai's stuff, I'm sure you already know, but head on over to thestand.co.uk, buy some tickets. Phil Jupitus, what are we meant to say? I grew up watching Phil on Nevermind the Buzzcocks. Phil started in poetry, he'll tell you in the episode, and then moved into stand-up comedy and became a staple of the British comedy scene and certainly on telly in panel shows. And Phil, yeah, he was a lot of fun. I didn't expect, you know, when you meet these people that you've known for 20 years but never met them, never known them personally, you're never sure what they're going to be like. And he could have been more gracious with his time. I remember even afterwards,
he was promoting the podcast, even when his episode wasn't on. So I really appreciate that, and I'm going to feel real awkward this week when I send him a little message saying, hey, Phil, your episode's coming out. He went, who the fuck are you? I'm like, we know we recorded the podcast 2.5 years ago. He's like, I think I remember. So hope you're looking forward to that. Glad to get to the end of the season. It's hard. It is hard. Mother fathers, getting these episodes out every single week and getting them, because you think that you're listening on a Wednesday. I'm doing this on a Sunday night, getting them ready for the Patreon subscribers on Monday morning. And you could be one of those people. I don't want to keep flogging the paid channel, but you could be one of those people. Go to patreon.com/myfirstgig and listen to them early, ad-free and extended. And as I said, you'll get the bonus episodes, 10 bonus episodes that you will not hear unless you are a member of the Patreon feed. I'll promote them on the social media, so if you see them there and you're wondering what's going on, those are those episodes. That's how you get them. But if not, like them. Like the page, follow the page, subscribe, tell a friend, share the stories. If you're enjoying a comedian, if you discovered a comedian that you didn't know before and you're now checking out their work, leave a comment under their tweets, under their videos and say, hey, heard you on my first gig and now I'm listening here. That means the world, and that helps us spread the name, spread the numbers and spread the love of my first gig. It's really fun doing this show, and I'm looking forward to coming back for season 4 and some fun people lined up. Thankfully now, the heavy flow of comedians from the UK and Ireland is happening, and there's some brilliant people visiting Dublin over the next couple of months. So if you are based in Ireland and you see who's coming and you think, God, I wonder if they're on My First Gig, don't wonder. Let them know that you want to hear them on the My First Gig podcast, because no doubt I'll be spamming their email. So if somebody else says it too, they might think that this is a bit legitimate and not just an excuse for me to go see their gigs for free. But I've been rambling on for too long. How long are we deep into this? Only 6 minutes. I'll do a shorter intro today because, as I said, the episode is over an hour long with Phil. And I don't want to keep you. Don't want to leave you waiting. Don't want to leave you hanging. So if you're here to listen to my first gig with Phil Jupilis, well, guys, then now is the time. Sit down. Put your headphones in. Get a snack. Maybe some crackers. Maybe some butter. Maybe some fresh toast. Maybe you got a crisp sandwich going on. Maybe a little bit of chocolate. Whatever your nibble of choice is. Get it inside you. And listen and relax and enjoy my first gig with the icon, Phil Jupilis. I read that you're living in, you moved to Scotland recently.
Yeah.
What's a little, is it a little quiet town like this?
It's small, way smaller than Howth. It's a fishing village, North Shore of the Forth Estuary, that I won't name, but I mean, there's only four of them. I'm just going to do the count now. There's a bunch around the edge of the coast, and I live in one of them anyway. Population is in the high hundreds. Don't think it touches 1,000.
Wow. What prompted that kind of change? Because I imagine you probably were in London for some time.
Well, I wasn't London. I lived suburban Essex. That's where I raised my kids, was a little town called Leon Sea, which is sort of like the posh end of Southend on the Thames. And I grew up there. And I think, Scotland, I have always loved, ever since I first started coming up to the Fringe and gigging there more regularly. There was a pull that I felt that I couldn't really quantify. I knew that I really liked it there. And then when it became apparent, you know, that my girls had moved away, one of my daughters emigrated. She lives in America with her wife now. And my my other daughter, she's in the Midlands. She's doing her own thing as well. And once the kids had gone, you know, we had choices to make. And we could, you know, we had a big old house that we didn't really need. So we kind of traded that in for a small sort of fishing cottage on the coast in Scotland.
Yeah, it's quite a departure now, but it's probably a nice change, I'd say.
Well, what this has enabled me to do, both geographically and emotionally and in all manner of other things, it's just a big change, and that adjustment I think if you make big changes in your life, you kind of, the rest of your life, perforce, has to fit in around the changes that you've pushed on yourself. So as a result of moving to Scotland, I'm at university now, so I'm doing a degree in fine art at the Duncan of Georgenstone College of Art and Design at the University of Dundee. So, and I'll be doing that for 4 years.
Well, so it's a full on thing.
Oh, yeah. So I'm kind of I'm semi retired now from these gigs that I've been doing in Ireland. That you know, this is, you know, we are talking now in Ireland, and I'm over here. I did for Aidan as a bit of a favour, because he wanted to try a couple of rooms out, and he quite likes it. If he can get someone like me that's got a big telly name, then he knows he can fill the room out. He can see what it looks like with, when it's full, and also it's, you know, it helps him build relationships with venues and people. So yeah, he's an interesting lad to work for, Aidan. I like him a lot. Yeah, and the thing about the scene in Ireland and the audiences in Ireland, they are definitely different from those in the UK. There's much more of a sense of a night out as something we have invested in and we will have a good time, you know.
Yeah.
Rather than a habit thing. Oh, let's just go and see some comedy. Bit shruggy. They're much more. There's a commitment.
Yeah. I spent a while in England, and it took me so long to realize that shows start at 8 o'clock, because people will go out, they'll have their dinner, they'll go to the show, and they'll go home.
Yeah.
Whereas here, shows won't start till 9. Some won't start till 9:30, 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
Because it's a night out. It is. Yeah. It's a full on.
Yeah.
You're not going home afterwards. You've got a babysitter.
That's that odd thing. It's because I'm used to the 8 o'clock. With me, and also it's because with my age, it's like I say to them, I said, look, the earlier you get me on, the better I'm going to be. Because, you know, after 9:30, I start to get sleepy. So, yeah, we kind of reached a kind of sort of compromise time of sort of 8:45.
Okay. But the trip in the shows, I guess, then lent itself to the course, because you were able to, you spent quite a bit of time in galleries this weekend as well.
Yeah, I've been... I think, you know, it's when you're in Dublin, and I know the thing is I every time I go to the National, the Irish National Gallery, I'm like, oh God, it's just, I forget how big it is. I mean, and there's obviously loads of, you know, there's stuff that I really want to hit, the Giacometti, there's that beautiful Venetian bead threading painting by John Singer Sargent. You know, there's the Irish abstract, the women Irish abstract painters of the 20s, whose names elude me at the moment, but there's three of them in the main galleries. I think it's sort of gallery 16, maybe 17, 16, 17. So if you're going by the numbers, between 15 to 18, they're in there. And the idea that these women, you know, at a time in the 1920s, were going to Paris, if you think about, you know, the way, you know, where the position of Irish women in society in the 1920s, how ballsy have you got to be to go to Paris to study abstract art in Irish society in the 1920s? You know, a time of flux for the nation in the wake of 1916, you know, the changes that were going on there societally. But as women to go, well, good, freedom, great, let's grasp it, let's do it properly. And I'm just fascinated that they went and they did this work. And the work itself is absolutely outstanding. So, yeah, we've got some hoovering going on out there. Good industrious.
I don't think we're touched just yet, but we'll see how we get on.
Yeah.
You mentioned a little while ago you've loved Scotland since going to the Fringe. When did you first go to the Fringe?
I think it was 1990 was my first Fringe. So we did myself and a comedian called John Mann. Did a show called the Live Essex Show, and we were there alongside that Hoover's getting closer and closer. She's right up at the door now. Listen, I don't know if you can hear it. She's actually now banging the door frame. If she wants to come in here, she's going to have me looking at her. But yeah, it was me. There was a poet called Little Dave, a musician called Murray Torkildsen. Another singer-songwriter called Rain Bowen, and we were all from Essex, and so we had the idea of doing this thing called the Live Essex Show, and we made all the classic mistakes of a first Fringe show. which is there was five of us. So economically, there was never going to be enough ticket money to give us any money for each other. No one was going to be making any money. The show was an hour and a half long, so we were paying for a double slot because it was longer than an hour. So we just made every mistake you could make about going to the Fringe. We got a lovely little flat that we all lived in together. Lorraine got a room to herself. I seem to remember I was in a sort of cupboard. I was sleeping in, you know, but we you know, there were sofas, everyone kind of, you know, found their way. But it was just, the thing is, it was just being at the Fringe was such an overwhelmingly extraordinary experience, you know, and it's like you suddenly realise you're in this city where there's just thousands of creative people making their work. And that is, that a feeling still sort of persists even, you know, at the Fringe now. Whereas I, because I've seen it again and again, all I've watched is the escalation of stand-up as an economically simple way of doing. So all I see in Edinburgh now is portrait photographs of someone making a face, their name, a pun title. Shows now are usually high concept shows, which means they're based around a theme. So it's like, here's my, you know, I got into Twitter arguments with trolls and here's what happened. And people that do, you know, PowerPoint presentations as their shows. And it's all, the grammar of putting on an Edinburgh show is attainable through technology now to everybody and the promotion. And so it's a quite sort of level playing field. But there are just thousands and thousands and thousands of people ostensibly doing the same thing. And I don't know how healthy that is for an international art festival.
That's what I wanted to ask, as you know, someone who's seen it, you know, I love hearing the stories of the Fringe in the 90s, but I've only experienced it in, say, the last 5 years.
Yeah,
and it's just, the enormity of it is...
I think that you... Certainly my thing is how you don't want to reinvent the wheel exactly, but how do you do it in a different way? And so that's why I, as a known television personality in the UK, so I thought, how can I do this differently? And I went, right, I'm going to do the free Fringe. I'm going to do free shows. And my agent thought I was insane. And now, but people were like, oh. And then once you get in and you start doing it, and you realise that it feels more like a festival when you do free shows to me, you know. I understand that, you know, the standard sort of ticketed way of doing things is there, but there appears to be an industry system for the Fringe of review websites like Chortle and everything. There now appears to be a, you know, acts that go up think, right, I need a good review from Chortle, and I need a good review from 1-4 review, and I need a good review from this. And they're, when are the review people in? When are the award people in? When's this? Everyone seems to be going up there with a career objective in mind. And I'm like, well, where's the joy in that? That you're going up there and it's turning something. I got into comedy because I didn't like work. And now this industrialized system for marketing comedy that the agencies and the promoters and the venues have, you know, I'm really not sure how good Underbelly adding to the whole Edinburgh thing has been. I mean, it's made Charlie and Ed a lot of money, but I'm not sure how good it is for the soul of the city. I quite like the, you know, it just seemed a little more ramshackle back in the 90s. But, you know, I realise now, and I'm fully aware that anybody listening to this is thinking, you stupid old cunt, what are you on about? Why are you, you know, moaning about how much better it was in the good old days? And I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, you know, that progress is unavoidable. And the way that Edinburgh is now, I just don't love it like I used to. I'm much more likely to go and see theatre or dance at the Fringe because I just find stand-up too overwhelming, just the sheer choice. I'll go and see mates doing stuff, you know.
But like, if you go by this year's numbers, I think on the two main free Fringes alone, you're competing with I think it's 4,500 shows.
Jesus Christ, think about that.
That makes no sense whatsoever. Because, but it is a, you know, it's an open invite. It's not even an invite.
Well, you think, oh God, it's just like, everyone goes, it's like it's a money-making machine. But like Glastonbury, Glastonbury's a money-making machine. But Michael Eavis knows every 4 years, take a year off, let people reset, stop doing it. And I think Edinburgh should do the same. I think there should be no fringe every 4 years. Let the city be the city in August.
And then maybe people then can like reevaluate.
And you know why they don't do that? It's because there's just too much money at stake. It's the majority of the city's income happens in those months. You know, like Travelodge charges four times as much for a room at the weekend in August. Four times as much. Look at the Airbnb rates in August for rooms. Just talk to comedians about some of the horror stories and some of the shitholes they end up staying in and what they're charged for them in Edinburgh. What people, you know.
And miles away at times.
Everyone is trying to make from this what should be an overwhelmingly positive thing has just become this. It's like this. It's a monster that's sort of out of control. And I genuinely think that they should not do it. They should stop it for a while. I'm not saying be like the Olympics. Even Manchester, the International Festival. How important is Manchester International Festival to the people of Manchester? It's an incredibly vital thing. And they could easily do it annually. But no, let's do it every 2 years. Let's not make it stupid. And I seriously think that the fringe 1 year should not happen. Let's just not do this. And I think the people of the city of Edinburgh that live there would be thanking you. I mean, and also, you know, the comedians in August, let's see how they react, what they do. Do they set up a festival somewhere else? Do they work harder at getting more gigs? What happens? What do they do? You know, let's see what the industry does and how it reacts to not doing that. But it simply won't happen because there's too much money at stake. You know, I just think it's not what it was. That's the nature of progress, you know. That is the nature of the world we live in, and I can't do anything to change that. These are just thoughts.
No, it's very interesting. So, as we touch upon your first gig, I want to ask you just before that, what's your first memory of comedy? And you can interpret comedy however you wish.
So that would be as a child. So my first memory of comedy in that someone who was going against the grain of what was around them and being me thinking, looking at someone in a situation thinking, you're funny, you're the funny one, you do something that the others don't do, and I like it. I don't know why I like it, but I like it. And you're funny. And there was a children's television program in the 1960s in the UK called Play School, which was on every day, and it was for toddlers, basically, for 3 to 6 year olds. It was just this show, and there were a number of different presenters on it. There was a very well known 1960s, 70s actor called Derek Griffiths used to do it. Carol, oh God, what was her name? Who a friend of mine ended up marrying one of them, her name eludes me. This is what I hate about being in my 50s, because basically the hard drive of my memory just pushes certain things out to make room for new shit. So I can't remember the names of all the Play School people. But Johnny Ball, Zoe Ball's dad, Johnny, was a Play School presenter. But there was this guy on Play School called Brian Kent, and he was funny. And you know, I remember talking about him when I was older with mates, and we were fairly sure he was a dopehead. I got to do an Edinburgh show with Brian Kent, strangely, which was about him. He used to be the voiceover of another children's television programme called Trumpton. And we did a show together called Trumpton Tales, where I just interviewed him every day. And the show was different every day, because we would just chat about different stuff. We had a basic introduction that was always the same. And then the first sort of three questions would be the same. And then I'd go off on a different tangent with him. So I worked with Brian for a while. We very, very sadly died a couple of years ago. He was just an absolutely wonderful man. But a really quirky guy. And so as a kid, I was aware that this guy was different. So that in terms of a human being funny, Kent was my first exposure to it. And then in terms of people in rooms telling jokes, the paradigm was, it's your comedians, it's your Bernard Mannings, your, you know, your Jimmy Joneses, people with bow ties and dinner jackets saying, my mother-in-law, you know, that. So I thought, that seems very strictured, very confined. So I wasn't sure how I felt about that. And then my grandfather and grandmother had a couple of long playing albums by Max Miller, who was a comedian in the 30s and 40s in the UK. Used to do musical, Max. And I listened to some of... I used to listen to those albums when I was like 8. And I could hear people like... Because he was filthy, so I didn't know why they were laughing. But the rhythm of comedy... And again, he's telling jokes. This became the thing, is the more that I listened to it live, it was telling jokes. And then in the mid-70s, I was, I think, maybe 13, maybe 14. So this would have been 75, 76. Steve Martin was on the British BBC chat show Parkinson. And this guy comes on with the rabbit ears and the banjo. And he's doing this stuff. And then he sits down with Parkinson and gets some scissors out and cuts Parkinson's tie off during the interview. And he's silly and he's daft and he's big and he's rock and roll. And he's and I'd never seen anything like it in my life. Clive James was being interviewed on the show as well. And Clive James was just pissing himself. Michael Parkinson was not enjoying it. And I'll never forget it. And then completely by accident, within 6 months of me seeing this guy, who I'd never heard of, who he was plugging the film The Jerk, I was in a record shop in Basildon, and in the bargain basement bin, I found the two albums, Comedy Is Not Pretty and Wild and Crazy Guy by Steve Martin. And I bought those albums, and I wore those fuckers out. I absolutely wore those albums out. So that was, you know, in terms of sort of comedy towards stand-up, that was what I was kind of exposed to. But comedy in general, being British, it's situation comedy, it's characters, it's Dad's Army, or it's the big variety show, so it's two Ronnies, it's Morecambe and Wise. Morecambe and Wise owned comedy. And then sort of as I was a kid, the kind of alternative side of it was your Oxbridge lot, was your Pythons, was your Beyond the Fringe and your Monty Python kind of posh boy comedy. And it was, let's not be in any way, there weren't any women doing comedy in the 70s. There simply weren't, even though there were. They were invisible. So it was just, you know, it was Morecambe and Wise, it was the two Ronnies, it was the Pythons, you know, who had Carol Cleveland come along. I should have called her Carol Cleavage because that seemed to be what they put her on in sketches for. She seemed to be so marginalised, it was unbelievable, you know. But, yeah. So the Pythons were along and then things like 40 Towers happened. And so the evolutions, stuff was changing as I was growing up. And then, so when I was in my late teens, that was when alternative comedy started. So that's the comic strip then. So that is Alexei. And things that people like Rowan Atkinson as well. So the posh side of it, Rowan Atkinson was, you know, exploding at the same time as Alexei Sayle and Rick and Aid and French and Saunders. And so I remember that as being a kind of... that there's change in the air, that something is happening. I went to see Alexei Sayle when I was 18 in Basildon. That was the first, I think that was the first actual stand-up gig I went to, because I went to see Rowan Atkinson just before live, and that was much more like a theatre show. That was like, it was very well-crafted and really brilliant, but it was definitely a, you know, oh, this is something different from Alexei was doing stand-up. And then came up the end and did Mr. Sweary, and I've never seen anything like that in my life. Genuinely never seen anything like that in my life. When your kind of jaw drops and you're watching this guy just using four-letter words but screaming them in a rhythm and a pace. you can't. And it to the point where it's like, what is this funny? And then he keeps doing it until it becomes funny, and it goes around the corner again until it stopped being funny. It's just a complete eye opener. It was just insane.
So through all that, you found different things that you enjoy, and that whether it's, you know, coming across Steve Martin and then finding the records and hearing the audience's laugh. What's it like then once you're first at those shows, whether it's Rowan Atkinson or it's like and then being part of that audience? Was that something different?
Yeah, I think you're aware certainly with the Alexei Sale gig, because people were weak with laughter at that sweary bit at the end. And I think part of the absurdity is he's just saying fucking cunt. It's just all he's doing. How is that funny? And so, but there were 300 of us in that room, weak. And so there's a power in that, you know. Being in that, seeing it live, I'm so glad I kind of made the effort. I saw Rick Mayall live, which was good, because when he went on tour doing stand-up, because most of how we knew him was the Young Ones and characters. So he did Rick from the Young Ones. He wasn't with Aid. So they had their kind of double act, Dangerous Brothers. So that they did. So Aid wasn't out with them. When Rick did the stand-up tour on his own, he actually went out with Andy De La Tour and Ben Elton. So Andy De La Tour went on first, and then Ben Elton came on and did stand up. And Ben Elton was excellent, you know, for all of the fact that he kind of went in a very different direction later on. Yes, I sort of feel sorry for Ben, because Ben made some, you know, some choices in his life, which was firstly to be very left wing and Labour, but then to become very establishment by the same token. And like, and he always wonders why people give him such a hard time. And it's like, you know, it's like, people just didn't like the fact that he's working with one of the biggest Tories in entertainment, Andrew Lloyd Webber, and people just don't like that. It just felt, and you know, it's you can't be kind of street political and then suddenly, you know, you've got Robert De Niro's money and Mr. you know, conservative. It seemed like the weirdest thing when he did the book for We Will Rock You.
Everyone was a bit
sort of what? But I thought he had a. I remember I met him in the street. Round about the time just after We Will Rock You had been running for a while, and it got terrible reviews, but it was incredibly successful. Who cares about the terrible reviews if you're a success? The crowds loved it. And that's it. He knew what people liked. He's such a good writer. I went to see a few of his plays, and they were, you know, he's great at plot. I read his early novels. The man knows plot. The man knows writing. He's a great writer. But he couldn't bear the fact that other comedians didn't like him. You've got to have a tough hide about it. And I'm thinking, what does he... He went off to live in Australia, you know. He's got to have a tough hide about it, I think, you know. But I remember bumping into him in the street, and I was quite upfront with him. I've got to say, mate, I couldn't believe it when I saw you sat with Andrew Lloyd Webber. You know, the last time I saw you live was, you know, the 1987 election, which was, you know, touch and go. He was doing a benefit at a marginal in Greenwich, and he was unbelievable. He's really good. Really angry, vitriolic stuff about what the Tories were up to back in the 80s. He was fabulous. And I'm like, I couldn't square it with you sitting next to Andrew Lloyd Webber. What's this all about? And his words to me were, well, Phil, you know, sometimes we've all got to pay the piper. And I'm like, what does that mean?
Some riddles.
Yeah, yeah. But I gigged with him a couple of times. And technically, as a live stand-up, he was really good, you know. But I didn't like what he did on telly as much as I did seeing him live. On telly, you could tell he was holding back so that he could say things on telly. He was just mitigating his language and his rhythm. And so I thought on television he was a weak stand-up. But live, I saw him, I'm trying to think. Gig with him once. Saw him twice. The two times I saw him, and in fact that time I gig with him, he was excellent.
I want to move on to your first gig now.
Yeah.
Now, but I know you probably have two. Is this?
Well, I've been trying. I've been thinking of that. I mean, there were three.
Okay.
But the thing is there's the third. I can't work out when it exactly was, but I know there was a third one. But yeah, we'll get to that.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What would you consider your first gig? Would it be those poetry sessions?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. First gig was definitely the poetry, and how that came about was in and of itself was sort of quite strange. So I before I was performing, I was a cartoonist, I was an illustrator, and I used to do stuff for music fanzines in the UK. So the fanzines were the independently produced little magazines that fans would make themselves, where they would, you know, use as an excuse to talk to their favourite bands, and that were an alternative to, you know, like the Melody Maker and Sounds and the NME, you know, and Record Mirror and all that. So they were just basically a kind of underground, self-produced music magazines, but they also incorporated football. I know a lot of them used to talk about football, certainly Richard Edwards, who did he did, come on, it was Out on the Floor. He used to talk about Colchester United, you know, in Out on the Floor. I know that Nick Taylor, who did New Youth in Hull, he used to write about Hull City on the back of every issue. So it was sport, it was football, it was, and at the time it was also, you know, the ranting poets were in the ascendancy in the early 80s, and so people like Attila the Stockbroker and Jules Denby and Stephen Wells, they were all doing gigs, and so they, again, they provided good copy for these fanzines. You know, they were great supporters and advocates. And to be honest, a lot of the poets were making their own fanzines as well. Swells, Stephen Wells did one called Attack on Bazag. Jules Denby did one. I know she did her own fanzine that was mostly her artwork and poems. And Attila did one called Tirana Thrash. So there was also a poet called the Big J. She did a fanzine out of Peterborough where she lived. There was, you know, so there was a scene that required content, and so they could write till the cows came home. They could do all their own editorial stuff. But and as I read fanzines, I realised that for their artwork and their visual content, they were nicking stuff out of comics and magazines in a sort of collage style. They would nick other people's cartoons or, you know. And I thought, well, why don't I do cartoons for these fanzines? And so I started drawing stuff, and I met Nick Taylor, who did New Youth, and I started sending him cartoons, and he loved them, and he started using them in New Youth. And what happened was Attila the Stockbroker saw my cartoons in Nick Taylor's fanzine, and then he asked Nick Taylor for my address, and he sent me a letter, Attila the Stockbroker, saying, I really like your drawings, I've got a book of poetry coming out, and I think I'd quite like you to illustrate it for me. Can we meet? And I was quite excited by this, because I was a big fan of Attila's. This was unbelievable to me. I was like, so excited. And so, it was, I'm pretty sure, So it's definitely 1983, and I think it was August or September 1983, the late summer 1983. Attila says, I'm doing a gig in West London in the Portobello Road. Why don't you come along and we'll have a chat about doing it? Can you bring some of your drawings for me to have a look at? And so me and a few mates, I said, oh, I'm going to see Attila do a gig. Why don't we go to the gig? I've got to have a meeting with him as well. And then we'll see the gig and then we can all come up. And so my mates, Lorraine and Liz and Gary, all came with me. And we went to this pub in the Portobello Road and I met Attila. And we sit down and I say, hello, I'm Porky. And he went, oh, I'm John. And we had a chat. And he said, so have you got some drawings? And I went, oh, yeah, I've got. And I gave him a folder, like an envelope folder. And it had the drawings in it. But I used to keep everything in the folder that I did creatively. So all the drawings are in there. But also there were, I'd started writing poetry. I'd been writing poems. And there were a few poems at the bottom of the pile. And so he's going through the drawings, looking at them, laughing, going, oh, these are good. Yeah. I like this, you know. And then he gets to the bottom of the pile and he finds a poem. He's reading it. And I went, oh, no, that's nothing. There's no more drawings now. That's it. He went, no, wait a minute. And he reads one. And then he reads the next one. And then he goes, you're going to do these tonight before my gig. And I'm like, what? He went, you're going to go up tonight before me and do these two poems. And I was like, no, I can't. He went, yeah, you're getting up and doing them. And he was like, how do you want me to introduce you? And so my nickname with my mates, and it had been for like 4 years, had been Porky, always had been. And I used to sign my artwork Porky. It was just like, and it was a partially sort of a tribute. There's a guy called George Peckham who... George Peckham was a record cutter. So when you made an album, George Peckham was the guy that actually made the actual cut the groove in the metal plate that would make the records. And you can always, now anyone that's listening to this podcast, get your old vinyl albums out and look at the inner groove, particularly anything from the 80s, 70s that you bought, anything, or maybe your mum and dad's record collection, and dig it out and have a look. And on the run-out groove, he used to write a Porky Prime cut. Scratch it into the vinyl on the inside run-out groove. So I've got loads at home with that on him, because this guy, George Porky Peckham, used to do it. And so partially, is a bit of a, you know, I thought, a Porky's a really good kind of working name. I like that. So that's why I used to sign the art Porky. And so he said, well, how do you want me to introduce you? And I just, and on the spot, I just went, Porky the Poet. And that was it. So that's how the working name came about.
What time of the day are we talking? That this was
in the evening. So it was an evening gig. So I met him at about 6. And we were having a few scoops. Gig started at 7:30. I went on stage... Yeah, I went on stage about 7:30.
You didn't have too much time to think about it, though.
Nope. He went, and I can't even remember what John said. He went, it's his first ever gig. You know, he's a really good cartoonist, but I just discovered that he's a poet as well, and his poems are really funny. Please welcome Porky the Poet. And I went on stage, and I did two poems. The first one I did was called They've All Grown Up in the Beano. And the second one was a dog shit poem. All Grown Up in the Beano, I could recite to you right now, easily. I can do that for you. I still remember it to this day. Dog shit one, I've forgotten.
Yeah. We got a little bit of the...
They've all grown up in the Beano. Dennis the Menace has got pubic hair. Biffo is well into anarchy now. He's more of a punk than a bear. Lord Snooty is a high court judge taking bribes through a Zurich bank and running with the Inner Avenue when he sold bunkers and castles to the Yanks. Grandpa is at last 6 foot under. Roger the Dodger is in the SPG, now dodging charges for murder. But Lord Snooty will help him, you'll see. The three bears are on racks in Harrods because Hanky shot them at last and Tisha was thrown out of Bass Street for being too pissed when in class. That's about half of it. Yeah, so...
yeah.
So that was it. So I did that poem. And then, so that night, it was like, okay, you can perform as well. They went down well, crowd, no heckling, no nothing, because it was poetry, though. And it was John, it was a crowd there for Attila. So it was, you know, it was, so they were kind of predisposed to listening to poetry, I suppose.
Were you, like, had you experienced poetry performance before?
I mean, I might have read them out at school. I mean, I assume I did at some time, you know. I used to like writing long story style poems. I remember that I enjoyed that. I mean, I was a washout at school because, particularly at big school, because there's at little school, you can be fascinating an individual and the teachers will indulge you and the other kids, you know, they don't see anything different. But when you get to big school, if you try to be different, then your students around you are like, what the fuck are you doing that for? Take the piss out of me. And suddenly life gets harder. And so I was a sort of like a top dog at junior school. And then I went to big school, died on my fucking ass because they didn't want to know about the fact that I was good at doing silly voices. I was always asked to do things in school plays at little school. You know, I remember one of my teachers did songs from the musical Oliver, did a little school concert. And she said, you know, you do that funny voice. She said, could you be like a Victorian chimney sweep? And basically she got me to compare her gig when I was 7. And I'm like, I was so ballsy when I was like, oh yeah, yeah. That sounds like a laugh. Yeah, I'll do that. And I remember ad-libbing. So she gave me things to say before the songs, but I remember definitely ad-libbing and getting a laugh when I was 7. So I think it's just, that's all it is if you're a bit of a show-off as a kid. Now, that can either be, it's the way in which it's done. It wasn't, I enjoyed it and I felt it was fun to do it, but all that had been beaten out of me by being at school. And I did a few school plays, but I quite like the anonymity, the kind of the flat sort of, you're just doing a play, you go up, you do a little bow, and that's it. You've said your piece, and that's it. You know, I did a few. We did Journey's End, we did Man for All Seasons. So I used to like acting at school, but generally performing, I just wasn't into. It was an idea. So, you know. And then, you know, so 83, I was 21. I was 21 when I did my first gig.
But it's apparent from hearing that bit that you did, you know, there's comedy in it.
Yeah.
It's very much, you know.
Yes, well, this is it. I mean, it's, the thing is that you have to understand at that point, I'd seen a lot of performance poets. I'd seen Ivor Cutler. I was a big fan of Ivor Cutler. I'd seen Attila a lot. I saw John Cooper Clarke was the first performance poet I saw. I saw John Cooper Clarke opening for Susie and the Banshees at Chelmsford Odeon. And that was a complete game changer for
because that was a thing of the time, whether it was poetry or comedy, you'd go on before bands.
Yeah. Which was basically what I then went on to do. You know, the thing is, a poet doesn't need a sound check. Poet doesn't have a load of equipment. Poet doesn't, you know, it's the portability of a poet as a support act. Paul Weller took me on tour with him. I went on tour with the Style Council in 1987, you know, because, and it was literally because his crew said, let's take Porky because we don't have to do any work. And even Paul's dad, John Weller, who was like, yeah, that's a really good idea. Nice, easy. Then we sound check. We don't have to bother with another band sound check. That's great. Less work. And so I did that. I did a tour with Billy Bragg. Billy took me out on the road with him. I mean, Billy was sort of the reason that I wouldn't be sat here talking to you if it wasn't for Billy Bragg, you know, because the thing is that I didn't know how to get more work. You know, I didn't know what to do.
Is that what lends up to the going from the poetry to the comedy? Like, what
made, well, I think what happened was, and it was an interesting, because I was performing and I started doing the poetry. I did so if you think it was, so what we're saying, so 1983, in that August 1983 was my first gig. I met Billy Bragg on the 8th of March 1984. So here's another first gig, my first paid gig. Would have been November 1983, and that was at the University of Sussex, opening for the Piranhas. in a club called The Crypt, and I got 20 quid. That was my first paid gig, and it was my first solo 20-minute set. So that's the second first gig. That was the first gig I got paid for.
When you say 20-minute set, then what are you doing? Is that still poetry?
Poems, poetry. Just poems. Yeah. So I had easily 40 minutes of poems to perform, but I did, you know, I did them, you know, I just picked my favourites and did that. They were sort of, some were political, most were just jokey ones. Lots of them were stories.
When you say that, like, they're stories, they're jokes.
Yeah.
And you know, you go home, you write them.
Yeah.
You take them, you perform them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, what's the difference? Is there a defining difference then between that and the, say, stand-up comedy?
Well, what happened is so, this is sort of what I was getting to, is that so I would, you'd introduce the poem and you'd tell a little story about, so this next one I'm going to do. So the, generally just do the first poem, introduce it. This one's called Band, do the poem. And then, hello, I'm Porky the Poet, la di da di da, chat, chat, chat. This next poem, chat, 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 chat. Do the poem. And so that was what the gig was, just poems with a bit of chat between. And I did a gig at the University of Leeds in, 86 now, I suppose. Yeah, 86 before, maybe late 85, 86. I did a gig at Leeds University opening for a band called Surfing Dave and the Absent Legends. And my James Brown, not that one, James Brown, who worked at the NME and ran, he did a fanzine of his own. He was Attack on Bazag. Yeah, that was Attack on Bazag, which is James Brown's fanzine. And Swells' fanzine, I said, was Attack on Bazag earlier. It wasn't. James Brown's fanzine was Attack on Bazag. Stephen Wells' fanzine was called Molotov Comics. Right, there we are. So, Attack on Bazag fanzine. And James was a mate, and he came to the gig. And I was staying at his house in Leeds, where he lived with his mum and dad. And we, after the gig, we're sat in his kitchen drinking cider. And he said to me, he said, you do know that the chat between the poems is now much funnier than the poems, don't you? And I'm like, what? He went, your chat, when you talk to the audience, it's funnier than those poems. Those poems are just, they're all right, but the chat is funny. And that was the first time I ever thought, I didn't even know chat could be comedy. But then I started going to see acts, and I was seeing people like Kevin Day and Mark Thomas. And I was meeting people like John Mann, and so I was meeting people who were just, because even then at that point in the 80s, I thought comedy, you needed jokes. You had to tell jokes. And I didn't realise it could be just bullshitty narrative storytelling. And I suppose through seeing like Alexis Sale and then seeing more and more people who were doing a less structured form of being a comedian, you know. And that is it. And so I started then in the late 80s transitioning basically from poet to stand up. And it was in about 89, I thought, because the thing is, I was trying to get gigs. I was a really good poet and a really good performer. But if you go to a comedy gig, I remember phoning the Comedy Store trying to get an open spot, speaking to Kim Kinney. And again, another one of the men, I would not be talking to you now if it wasn't for Kim Kinney, the late Kim Kinney, an absolute, you know, launched the career of so many comedians in the UK, that man, giving them a proper shout at the store, giving them their chance. And Kim, I remember phoning the Comedy Store. Kevin Day gave me the phone number of the Comedy Store and said, call and ask Kim for an open spot. And I remember the phone ringing, you know, Comedy Store. And I'm like, hello, can I speak to Kim Kinney, please? Yes, Kim. I went, hi, Kevin Day gave me your number to ring to talk about an open spot. What's your name? And I went, oh, it's Porky the Poet. He went, we don't book poets, and hung up the phone. So that day, I thought, I've got to use a different name. I've got to get a different name. So I decided to start working. as Phil Jupitus. So I gave it a couple of weeks, and I phoned a couple of weeks later and said, my name's Phil Jupitus. Kevin Day told me to ring for an open spot. And I had to do, I did 3 open spots, and he was never there. They went well, but, you know, I kept coming back. I did 3, and I kept coming back. I kept phoning, and eventually I did one, and he saw me, and then I got booked. And I would say, you know, my first proper booking gig at the Comedy Store, I kind of consider my first stand-up gig, and I couldn't tell you when that was. What I'd like to do, actually, is go down to the archive at the store and look and see when that was. But it would have been 1990 or 1991. And by this time, I was also a parent, so the pressure of having to get work was much more upon me. So there were 3 first gigs, in a way. There was my first gig where I got pushed on stage by Attila. My first paid gig that I got, opening for the Piranhas, because the first time you get money for it, then you're a professional. And then, so that was the first professional poetry gig and the first professional stand-up gig. I always consider the Comedy Store, because that's like the National Theatre of Comedy. That's the place, you know. And so yeah, I've got 3 first gigs.
Briefly about the transition, do you consciously, like, so when you're told, oh, it's the chat between,
yeah,
is funny,
yeah,
are you preparing that chat?
So what I do is because I've never written stand-up, I can write poems. That's what I love about poems. And the funny thing is even now, all of my good stand-up comes out of chat before poems. So at the Edinburgh Fringe I've done 6, I think, 5, 6 poetry shows at the Edinburgh Fringe, at the Free Fringe. So I always do the poetry at the Free Fringe, and it always fills out, and people always come and see it. And I am still to this day developing stand-up ideas in the chat between the poems. There's still stand-up ideas are emerging when I'm kind of chatting between poems on stage, because I'm very loose now, I'm very confident. The problem is now, is being 57, is in the old days, I'd like say something funny before a poem and remember it, yeah, and do it again. And literally, I'm just forgetting shit now. I used to, the other way of generating material that was really useful to me, and again, I've got to thank Lee Evans, one of my most successful bits when I started as a stand-up, was it used to be a routine I did about why Britain never went to the moon. And it was just, the conceit was, astronauts from Essex, you know, and it was about and it ended up with astronauts on the radio, but getting a minicab company from Southend on, you know, being a mission control, this is panel 13, and I remember, it's a pick up in Basildon. Don't fuck me about, Dave. I remember it was that, and that bit came about because I was doing a gig. And Lee Evans was always late for gigs. And I was the compere at this gig. And the promoters at the side of the stage going, he's not here, keep going. He's not here, keep going. And so I was on stage for 25 minutes just bullshitting and chatting with the audience, waiting for Lee. And I came up with that Apollo 11 bit, Essex Apollo 11. I can't even remember what I called it, on stage. And that was a bit of material that kind of, if you do a good bit of material and you're doing it at clubs, it'll last you a year, a good bit of material, you know. And so I've got Lee to thank for that, you know.
Is that how you always did it once you started out?
Yeah, I would generate ideas on stage through improvisation. And so the thing is what was really good for me was that I emceed a lot, and I'm also, I was very loose and improvisational as an MC, and so was constantly writing stuff. I remember Stan Nelson used to be the stage manager at the Comedy Store. Certainly in the years I was there, it was Stan. It was Ali Day, Kevin Day's wife, used to be the stage manager at the store, and then she moved on. I mean, she's still stage managing now. She's a remarkable woman. And in fact, it was Ali that got me my open spots with Kim, because when Kim wasn't answering phone calls, Ali would say, come and do it. So again, Ali Day is one of the reasons I'm sat here. But Stan Nelson. I remember Stan Nelson. He used to watch me comparing at the Comedy Store sort of week after week. And I remember him saying to me once, he went, "You burn more good material than any other act I've ever seen at this gig." He goes, "There's stuff that you do one night and I never see it again." He said that you could build a complete set around. And he goes, "What the fuck are you doing?" And it's like, and I never really cared. I always liked the fact, if you've got like a sort of improvisational nature, I love the fact that you say something amazing and it never happens again. There's something kind of nice about that, you know. Whereas now, you know, acts, you know, you've got that bit there, you've got a phone there, you can just record everything. So now acts just record every gig that they do, and if they say something new, then it gets written down. And certainly when I'm developing a new show, I use the record and redo method, you know. It's interesting, I did a whole tour of improvised where I played three different characters. And I always remember if I came up with something funny, like at one gig, I'd always try and bring it back at the next gig, and it never worked as well. Second time out, it's never as good. There's an energy. When you're thinking of a comedy idea on stage, live, it's got a life to it. But it never has second time out. It really doesn't. And you have to, that's something that I quite like. I like the fact that moments happen in a gig that are never going to happen again. I like that. It gives...
And the audience can tell as well. Because there's always a different laughter.
Yeah. I mean, there's something that I said last night that we got very giddy about last night on stage. I was here at Hoth, and I can't remember it now for the life of me. And it just became... It was about 3 minutes of the gig where I started talking about something locally. Now, I remember what it was. It's like, I'm chatting to them. And I said, "So I've moved to Scotland. And I live right near the sea." And I mean, obviously, we're at Hoth now. So does anybody live near the sea? And they were completely silent. And I'm like, "Don't take the piss." I'm like, "Don't take the piss. Come on now." I'm like, "We live right by the sea. Some of you must live near the sea." Silence. And I'm like, "Look, I know I'm asking you questions, but if you answer me, it's not fucking collaboration." I said, "Are the council in? Are the fucking council in? What's going on? Is this a rah thing? You don't fucking answer questions if it's a tan asking a question." And then I got into that and it became a big sort of thing. And I started, don't answer the fucking questions. You don't want to be, don't want you fucking informer bastard. Don't you tell him if we lived in the fucking sea." And I got into all that. And it just belongs to that gig, that moment, you know. I love that. I used to love that.
And that's the bit that people will be telling today.
Yeah, but that is it. The thing is, and it's, I always remember, Mark Lamar's one of my favourite stand-ups, and he was always, because he was very talking to the audience about things. He used to talk to his audience a lot. His live video, if you get Mark Lamar's live video, I think it's called something like, 5 million Mark Lamar fans can't be wrong. It's based on that Elvis album with the gold suit on the cover. And you can only get it on VHS. If you can get that Mark Lamar live video, there was a guy in the front row with a neck brace. And that is what most of the video is about. He did not put that man in there. The guy was just there. And it's very, very funny. But, you know, I remember... You know, his agent going, why did you go on a bloke with a fucking neck brace? Why did you? And it's like, well, he was there. And it was like, so, but I'd seen him elsewhere on that tour. There's no neck brace bloke. It was really, really funny. But where's the neck brace bloke? You know, it's just like, just one of those things.
Mm. If we can, well, a final question.
Yeah.
Let's do gig 3, Comedy Store.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Before you go on. And this is the reflective piece now.
Yeah, yeah.
If you could pull yourself to one side right before, 5 minutes before you're going on stage, and today give yourself, what, you say 1990, what would you say in your ear today looking back?
Record them. Because genuinely, you know, I think that I've spunked about 4 really good one-hour shows at the Wall over the last 35 years. You know, I could have had. The thing is, I think I've had a less successful in terms of, you know, when I look at my contemporaries that have gone on and they end up, when I see mates that go out on tour and they end up, they finish their tour at Hammersmith Apollo and they do a night at Hammersmith Apollo on their own. I'd love to have done that. I never did. I've done live at the Apollo. I've played the Apollo loads, but I never got to that level. You know, I'm at this kind of sort of 200 people will come and see me anywhere I go. I never, you know, I was on Buzzcocks. It's one of the most popular comedy shows in the UK for 18 years, and I never turned that into, you know, live gig success. I was still a good live performer, but I didn't. Bigger venues. I didn't follow the prescribed trajectory because I was too busy doing other things. I was always very distracted by something. If I'd not done it before, that's how, you know, for fuck's sake, I've done, you know, I was Edna Turnblad in Hairspray in the West End. I was dressed up as a woman for money for 3 months. I launched the breakfast show on BBC Six Music. You know, I did that for 5 years. That's another great regret. I think what I'd have said in, no, right, here's what I'd have said in my ear, never stop doing stand-up. I've stopped doing stand-up. In the last 35 years, I would say 12 of those years I've done no stand-up. I, like, stopped doing it. Just stopped. I should not have stopped doing stand-up. Should always have done stand-up. And I should have kept doing the Comedy Store. I should have always done the Comedy Store at least once every 2 months. Go back and do the Comedy Store, even if it's just a Thursday night. Never use that ability to do a really tight 20. Because now, if you put me on the Comedy Store now, do a 20, I don't know, I'm a fucking arse, because it takes me 20 minutes to remember what weight to face. When I do my live gigs, I know that I've got an hour to slowly build a relationship and a rapport with the audience. Whereas, you know, I'm just a slower, more laconic old man performer, you know. Whereas the ability to do a really good 20-minute set at the store, you know, that all, most of my mates I know kept doing that. I wish I kept doing that. You know, I miss that. There's something about the camaraderie backstage at the Comedy Store. But some of the greatest nights of my life were in that dressing room. Just sat there laughing. And the thing is when I think about when we started our scene of comedians, when I started, me and my lot. My contemporaries who started doing stand-up at the same time as me, like Eddie Izzard, Joe Brand, Mark Thomas, Kevin Day, Jack D started at the same time as me. So Jack, trying to think who else, because there was a little generation before, and I'm just all the people that I started about the same time. So yeah, so it's Jack, Joe Brand, Mark Thomas. That's definite. Harry Hill started after me. I remember Harry coming along. I don't even know what my point was.
Stick at it.
Yeah, it's just kind of, yeah. I just wish that I'd had a better go, really. But, you know, can't grumble. You see, the thing is, when I look back at what I've done, I just think it's been a charmed bloody life. Buzzcocks was, you know, one of the longest running comedy shows on BBC Two, did that for 18 years. The work that I've done in musicals, I've been in The Producers, I've been in Spamalot, I've been in Hairspray, I've been in Urine Town, which was one of my favourites. The radio that I've done, I've been on, I used to listen when I was a child to I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue, and I've been on it 3 times. It's one of my favourite ever radio shows. I've been on Just a Minute, you know, which, you know, was not really a favourite of mine, but certainly to go on it is a singular broadcasting honour. You know, I've done, been on shows, you know, I've got no regrets at all about how the career went. No regrets at all. And all I ever think is it might have been nice to do it slightly differently. But I think that all the time anyway, because that seems to be my predominant thought is, how can I do this differently? You know, how can we do this that it's not been done before? Which is why I'm not sure I'll ever do Edinburgh again now, because I just think it's too busy. I'd rather think of something else to do in August, comedy-wise. Go somewhere else and do something else. Because I just think that Edinburgh now, it's more like a trade fair than a festival. It's somewhere to go to, you know, it's somewhere for young people to go and show off to each other. I think I've said my piece in Edinburgh now, and I've got nothing new to add. And until I have, shut up and go do something else.
Do something fun.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm at uni, mate.
There you go.
Thanks for this, Dwayne. It's been really good fun.
Thank you so much, Neil.
Cheers.
And there we go, folks. That was Phil Jupitus on My First Gig.
an amazing episode. I think you can agree, if you're still listening now, an amazing episode. There's that moment in the interview when I just say, oh, do you remember any of it? And he doesn't even say yes. He doesn't even say, oh, I know it word for word. He doesn't say, will I recite some for you now? I go, hey, do you remember any of that first poem? Bang. And he recites the whole thing. And I'm just sitting there. I remember we were in a conference room of his hotel that he was staying in. And you can actually hear a little bit of doors opening just as that happens. A guy came in trying to drag a Hoover out. And we're in this huge conference room that probably sits at any time 200-300 people. And it's just me and him on a desk that he dragged over. He was very much going, no, we're sitting down. We're getting comfy. This room is ours now. And I'm glad for that, because that's not the kind of bravado that I have. I'm a little shy boy. It doesn't work for me. But guys, if you enjoyed Phil Jupiter's On My First Gig, then head over to Instagram. Let him know. That's where he lives these days. He's not a Twitter boy. He's an Instagram boy. And he's studying art in Scotland. And he was over here studying some art. And, you know, you're never too old, never too young to get into these new avenues in your life. But that's where he lives now, sharing a lot of art. But he still shares a lot of comedy. So it's no hassle if you share with him that you enjoyed hearing them on My First Gig. As I said at the start of the show, if you want to hear these episodes early and free and extended, go to patreon.com/myfirstgigpod. If you are sick to your stomach that these episodes are going to be gone for the next 2 months, there's going to be no new episodes until 2023, and you go, God, why? Where am I going to get my new podcast? And you know, go to Patreon, subscribe to the Club Comic tier, and you will get bonus episodes every single Friday for 10 weeks. You think this series has been long? That's 10 weeks is what? If we're in the end of November now, 10 weeks is going to take us until February. Like, think of February 2023, and you could have episodes every single week until February 2023 if you subscribe to patreon.com/myfirstgigpod, the stars of the Irish comedy scene. And at the end of these episodes, I usually let you know who's on next week, but I don't know. Who's the start of episode 4 or season 4? I don't know, guys, but I will tell you, kicking off the stars of the Irish comedy scene exclusively on Patreon is the amazing Jim Elliott. Now, that's a bit of a loophole. Jim Elliott is from Washington, D.C., my friend, as he likes to say, but Jim Elliott has been performing comedy here in Dublin for the last 10, 12 years, and a fantastic story about his first ever gig. I just realised now, he was telling some story. Look, yeah, he goes in, car park, shooting, bit of a weird story, but if those two things don't sound like your first ever comedy gig, well, it sounds exactly like Jim Elliott's first comedy gig, so go subscribe and listen to those, and tell your friends, hey, do you like comedy? Do you like all these famous faces? Well, go listen to My First Gig with me, Dwayne Dugan. You can follow me on all social medias at Dwayne Dugan. If you are in Dublin, if you're in Ireland and you want some comedy in your life, go to Cherry Comedy at Whelan's every single Monday night in Whelan's of Wexford Street. Guys, how do I close out a season other than say thank you so much for tuning in? The response has been great since we swapped to Acast. Because did you not know this podcast is powered by the beautiful folks at Acast? Obviously, you can get your podcast wherever you choose, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher. But if you listen on Acast, oh baby, is it not clearer? Oh baby, is it not smoother? Oh baby, do we not just feel a little bit more special? I know I do. Hope you don't mind the ads at the top, the bottom, and the middle of this show. If you do hear the ads, please don't skip them. Listen to them. Every little second that you listen kicks back a little bit of dosh to My First Gig and lets me, I was going to say, helps get more podcasts. These podcasts are free. I just email comedians and hope that they're bored in Dublin and they've got nothing to do because they didn't bring any of their loved ones with them. Any money you give is going to go to my, you know, my white chocolate Oreo addiction. Okay? If you're okay with that, I'll keep doing these podcasts. Thank you so much for joining me for season 3 of My First Gig. 30 episodes in the bank. Didn't think we'd get this far, certainly with the pandemic putting it all on a hold. But if you have had fun, if you haven't, even if it's your first one and you're just here for Phil, go back, guys. Go back, go to Spotify, go to Apple. As I said, go to Acast Plus. And you can hear all the episodes with James Acaster. You can hear the episodes with Ardal O'Hanlon, Reginald D. Hunter. Are you watching I'm a Celebrity right now? Yeah? You're enjoying the antics of Sean Walsh? Go listen to Sean Walsh on My First Gig. before he had the Strictly Come Dancing kissing scandal. Don't mind that. We don't talk about it. It didn't exist back then. All of the episodes, Todd Barry, Joe Lycett. Are you watching the World Cup? Are you boycotting the World Cup? Did you see Joe Lycett threaten to set fire to €10,000 in response to David Beckham taking all those millions from the Qatari people? Then yeah, you want to hear James Joe Lycett's first gig? Oh, guys, I've made too many mistakes and I'm clearly not going to edit these little mistakes out. So, look, that's my time to go. Go back and listen to all those episodes. They're on YouTube, they're on iTunes, they're on Stitcher, they're on Spotify, and most importantly, they are on Acast. Exclusive episodes coming next Friday to patreon.com/that's my first gig. Until then, I will see you in 2023. Happy Christmas, happy year. We're back, guys, and we're coming back a lot sooner than we did last time. Thank you so much for joining me. I've been Dwayne Dugan, and I bid you farewell. I say good night, mwah, and goodbye. Bang.
It's the My First Gig podcast. Whoa.
You've been listening to the My First Gig with Dwayne Dugan on Acast. Follow online at My First Gig Pod or at Dwayne Dugan. For classic episodes, ad-free, early access, and more, head to myfirstgigpod.com. This is My First Gig with Dwayne Dugan, powered by...
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast. Enjoy.